This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Over the last few weeks, the country's been looking back at the Watergate scandal and the eventual resignation of President Richard Nixon. Last weekend marked the 40th anniversary of Gerald Ford being sworn in to succeed him. One of the central figures in the Watergate scandal was former White House counsel John Dean. He was described by the FBI as the master manipulator of the cover-up. He's also credited with tying Nixon to the scandal. Coming up, we'll hear from a former advisor to Richard Nixon, political operative Roger Stone. His new book blasts Dean's involvement in Watergate, accusing him of shifting the blame to Nixon and whitewashing his own role. But first, we're going to listen back to a conversation I had with John Dean and Hartford Current columnist Kevin Rennie. It was live on stage at a conference put together by the Hartford County Bar Association. I asked Dean to describe exactly what Watergate was.
We're still trying to figure that out, actually. I've been at USC as a visiting scholar for about two decades, and it's been at least two decades, maybe three or four, since young people had any idea what Watergate was. It's defined in dictionaries, and I actually noticed this not long after it was all had come to sort of a rest, as abuse of high office occurring during the presidency of Richard Nixon. It came very quickly, and it happens during Watergate, to mean much more than a bungled break-in at the Watergate. It becomes a symbol for abuse of power. And increasingly, items are swept into that. To say it happens during Watergate, when the dirty tricks start to surface from the campaign, that expands it as the first time. And the Washington Post is very effective in doing this, in broadening it out to make it much more than, as I say, a bungled burglary. So it happens early, and it continues, and then everything that Nixon did that was abusive suddenly is swept under that label. In fact, when the Congress gets around to taking Nixon's papers, his tapes, what have you, they instruct the Congress and the General Accounting Office to come up with a set of regulations that define Watergate. And the ultimate definition really includes everything that the Watergate special prosecutor investigated, everything that the House impeachment inquiry investigated, everything that the Senate Watergate committee, which was actually a study of campaign practices, those all fit now under the label of Watergate. So it's pretty broad and pretty inclusive.
Kevin Rennie from the Hartford Current, thanks for joining us for this conversation as well. I'd like you to just quickly chime in, and from your perspective, what do you perceive Watergate to be?
Well, I think that the definition that you first stated is what it broadly was. Of course, what it began as was what the White House, at least in the public mind, what the White House tried to pass off as a third-rate burglary of the Democratic National Committee headquarters in the Watergate complex on a June night in 1972, because they were concerned about the president's reelection.
Actually, to be technical, it wasn't the White House that did that. It was the Washington Post is literally on the scene because their police investigator, their guy with the link with City Hall, tips them off. They are there at the scene at the same time the police are there, for all practical purposes. And they own the story from the – and they start defining the story from the very outset.
But it was the Nixon people who wanted to diminish it as just a third-rate burglary.
I'm going to be hyper-technical technical with lawyers. It's actually Ziegler responding to what we don't know at that point that sounds like a third-rate attempted burglary. Nobody at the White House at that point really understands what's going on. We're baffled. I mean, it's so stupid. There's such high risk. I'm somebody who's now just completed a project that I should have never taken on, which was to listen to every Richard Nixon Watergate-related conversation. I thought that probably when I started the project, the bulk of them had been done by the Watergate Special Prosecution Office, which did, I learned, about 80 tapes. Next, historian Stanley Cutler, who forced the archives to release early a lot of the tapes, does about 320 partial transcripts of Watergate conversations. I thought, well, that's pretty well going to answer all the questions I was interested in. But the first thing I looked at is how many transcripts or conversations really were there. And there are another 600 conversations nobody even outside the archives ever heard. So there are about 1,000 conversations where Nixon is discussing Watergate. So, as I say, there were partial transcripts of maybe 320. The Watergate Prosecution Office, maybe 12 of those 80 they did are really good because they were used in the trial. The rest of them are largely FBI secretaries who took a crack at them, and sometimes they don't even know who's talking when they were trying to do the transcript. So anyway, the third-rate burglary is an effort to consciously cast it by the White House at that point. Now, and as you know, I'm not exactly an apologist or a defender of the Nixon administration, but I have, as a result of this now, gotten this encyclopedic knowledge of what happened and when.
Well, what the burglary brought to the public,
right,
or at least led the public to learning, was this wider mechanism that the Nixon White House had unleashed in what looks like paranoia, really, of against its enemies. And of course, we have John Dean here, so I have to ask him about the White House enemies list, which became sort of shorthand for how the world began to view the Nixon White House shortly after he'd won one of the greatest re-election victories in American history. But just over a year before that victory, Mr. Dean wrote in a memo that the White House enemies list was how we can use the available federal machinery to screw our political enemies, including grant availability, federal contracts, litigation, prosecution, which prosecution really, really means criminal prosecution. When you wrote that, two questions. The first one is, what threats did Carol Channing, Bill Cosby, and every black member of the House of Representatives pose to what you call our administration?
I love the media because you take all these different things and able to cast them and recast them into a picture that
this
looks,
is the memo.
No, I understand that. But understand what happened. There are lots of threads that go to make that. First of all, I almost got fired for not writing that memo. I had refused to do it. But
you buckled.
No, I didn't buckle. I wrote a memo that I thought was so obnoxious they would reject it. The second part of the memo had an approve, disapprove, what have you, at the end of it. I was flabbergasted when I wrote this outrageous memo, giving them what they wanted. And if you notice also, my office is excluded from that operation. This is something that I don't want any part of. I think it's absurd.
But then you took this memo and the first list to the IRS.
No. Never went outside my file drawer.
Let's
get into the enemies project, because sure. It was a very calculated move on my part to put Watergate in its much larger context. Having listened to all the tapes of what they expected with my testimony, it was not what they expected. They thought I would go up and make charges about the president. I decided to do it very differently. I thought people needed to understand how this White House operated, how something like this could happen, where all this came from. And one of the projects was the enemies project. It was a surprisingly small part of the project. It was run out of Chuck Colson's office, where he had a fellow by the name of George Beall, who was a dollar-a-year consultant, extremely comfortable financial person, and he would collect the names of the people who were the so-called enemies. There were, I guess, a half a dozen lists. that I finally turned over. The person who this was set up with was the senator from Connecticut, Lowell Weicker, who happened to have been my neighbor. In fact, I sold Lowell my house when I left town. Took a note from him. I trusted him. anyway, the enemy's project, I knew, would have the impact it did. And as Nixon writes in his memoir, it's the sort of thing they never recovered from. But it helped to explain in very lucid terms the mentality, which there was.
But at the time that it was created, you're talking about later, at the time it was created,
nothing happened.
People didn't know about it, though.
Nothing happened at the time it was.
Clearly they had an intent. They had an intent to punish people who just disagreed politically with Nixon.
They insisted I write the memo. There are other memos in the file where Haldeman's aides are talking about Dean won't cooperate, won't write these things, won't prepare them, lets the program fall down. Nobody's implementing it. You cannot name anybody based on that program who was ever the subject of any attack, any contract was ever, in other words, the federal machinery was never used to screw them. It got tremendous press play, but it got overplayed.
Today we're listening back to a conversation I had live on stage at an event at the Hartford County Bar Association earlier this year. Our guests were Nixon White House counsel John Dean and Hartford Current columnist Kevin Rennie.
What led to a need for an enemies list? What led to the deep, deep paranoia and wiretapping and activities that, again, later came under this cover of all falling under the Watergate heading? What was the atmosphere at the time?
The answer is very simple. Richard Nixon. In any White House, the president sets the tone totally. If the president wears a hat, everybody in the administration wears hats. If the president has a fire in his fireplace, everybody who has fireplaces has fires in their fireplace. It is influenced tremendously by the man who has obtained the office. So that sets the mood, sets the tone, sets the style, and everything is there for one purpose, really, to please and satisfy and deal with him, both in his policy and his politics. And that's a place where the politics dominate the thinking. There's no question. It's a highly political office. And that's as true as of Nixon as it was his predecessors and his successors. So he does set the tone. And like it or not, and it seeps out soon. The media is very good at flushing this sort of thing out. It was a voluntary act for which many of my colleagues, because they knew really it wasn't as deep as it was portrayed by the media, but there were badges at one point people had who had their name on the enemies list, and they were flabbergasted to find themselves on the list. I don't know how the criteria was developed to make this list, but it made my point. That was the important thing.
At what point in your tenure there, did you begin to think, these are not things or people that I want to be associated with? And what did you do at the time? Give me an example of the very first act you took in defiance of what you thought was illegal or unethical, immoral activity by those in the White House around you.
When I first arrived, I was given an assignment. I wasn't sure if anybody had been thinking what the White House counsel should be doing, but clear enough, there was. My secretary I brought over with me from the Department of Justice gave me a sealed envelope for my eyes only. And it was, had I not been at the level I was, I might not have ever been told exactly what it was. It was from the staff secretary. And it said, it had been noted in the news summary that a magazine had charged Vice President Agnew with planning to cancel the 1972 election, which is not a small event. And I wondered how he was going to do this. And the assignment from the staff secretary went on to say that it looks, this is the sort of thing that we should probably commence a tax audit of this magazine, a new publication called Scanlon's Monthly. This is my first document, and I, as I say, had I not been at the level I was at, I probably wouldn't have been told what it was, but I called the staff secretary, who was younger than I'm in my early 30s, and I said, John, I said, what is this assignment from you? He said, well, it's really not from me. I go in the morning and collect the president's news summary, and in the margins of the news summary, he'll write various assignments. And he has sent this assignment, he read this piece in the news summary and sent this assignment over to you, and the bottom line was to start a tax audit against this magazine, Scanlon's Monthly. Well, I thought about that, and I said, you know, it seems, I'm literally days on the job. And my first reaction is, well, good counsel tells you when not to do something, and this seemed pretty silly to me. The magazine was not successful. Nobody had paid any attention to this crazy article that Agnew was going to call off somehow the 72 elections. The whole thing was absurd. So I wrote my first memo to the president, in essence saying, do nothing. Just let it go. And soon I got back another memo saying, this doesn't address the problem. Take a closer look at this. In other words, he wanted something done. Well, the dining room in the basement of the White House in the West Wing is called the Mess. It's run by the Navy, and there's a big table that's larger than these round tables here where the staff sits when you don't have a guest or something like that, and staff comes and goes at the table, and I happened to go there one evening, and a fellow by the name of Murray Chotiner was there, and I knew just enough about Chotiner to know that he was a lawyer. He'd been with the president for a long time. He was actually the campaign manager for Nixon's first race for Congress back in the late 40s. And I was talking to Chotiner about this, and I'm saying, you know, it seems to me that this raises some questionable issues. I'm just starting to look in the tax code, and I'm not sure that there's any statutory authority for the president to do anything. And Murray looks at me and says, well, John, he said, the president's the head of the executive branch. He wants to start a tax audit. He can start a tax audit if anybody wants to. And I said, well, Murray, I said, there are also some provisions in here about the impropriety of that activity. And Murray turned to me and said, John, first of all, let me tell you something. You shouldn't be talking to me about this. I said, why not? He said, well, this is the sort of thing that's given to you, and this place operates on a need-to-know basis. I don't need to know this, but what you do need to know is that if you don't do what the president's asking you to do, he'll find somebody who will. He said, he was trying to be guiding and give me some advice about how the place worked. So I took that assignment, and not quite sure exactly what I would have done next, but a fellow by the name of Jack Caulfield had been assigned to my office. He had been with Ehrlichman, my predecessor. He was a former New York City detective, and Jack was on his way to the Treasury Department to have some sort of law enforcement job. And I showed Jack the problem, because I didn't have any idea how somebody starts a tax audit. And I have reluctance about it. And Jack looks at it, this is no problem, I'll take care of it. He comes back to me about 10 days later and said, you can tell the president the tax audit's in the works. That was the first time I really, early in the job, crossed the line.
So, and we have to take a break here, but I just have to ask, because I think this is at the root of what Kevin's asking about, is as I've read your stories, listened to you speak about this over the years, there are a number of these instances like this, small and large, ones that are widely reported, ones that aren't. Why didn't you walk away and say, you know what, these people aren't doing things right? I know I'm a 30-something-year-old lawyer. I know this is a great gig for me, and it's important for my career, but why didn't you just say, I can't do this now?
Well, I did want to at one point. Very quickly, I decided after my first vacation, where I took a trip to Europe, and I came back in September of 71, and I had some, just in a sense because of my position, but I also knew a lot of people, and had a job offer, actually a couple job offers, to leave the White House and went in and told my superior, Bob Haldeman, that I wanted to leave. He said, you can't. I said, what do you mean I can't? He said, well, you owe it to us to stay through the election in 72, because I said, listen, I think my deputy, Fred Fielding, who later becomes Reagan's counsel, then serves as George Bush's, Bush 2's counsel. I said, he's quite capable and can handle this. He said, no. He said, you owe it to us to stay. And he said, what are you looking at and what's your enticement to leave? And I told him the jobs. He said, well, you've obviously gotten those offers because we brought you here to the White House. And he, in essence, told me, you're burning your bridge. You're going to be a persona non grata. You're going to pay a price if you leave because we want you to stay. Mm-hmm. So it was pretty hardball. And I, you know, nothing of great moment had happened. I had not bent the rules. I had passed it on. So I figured I would learn how to survive. And the other thing is I didn't know exactly how it was played in the big leagues. I had this question repeatedly. I was young, and I said, you know, maybe you just don't understand the way this city really works. And this is a question I have throughout my early days.
That's former White House counsel John Dean speaking about the Watergate scandal and the Nixon administration that he served in. Hartford current columnist Kevin Rennie also joined us live on stage earlier this year at a conference hosted by the Hartford County Bar Association. Dean's new book is called The Nixon Defense. Coming up, we'll hear from another Nixon advisor who is criticizing Dean's book with his own account of the Watergate scandal. You can join the conversation on our website, WNPR.org, or find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. We're looking back on the Watergate scandal, which culminated just over 40 years ago with the resignation of President Richard Nixon. Coming up, we'll speak to Roger Stone. He's a former advisor to Nixon and a longtime political operative. But first, we'll continue a conversation that I had live on stage at a conference sponsored by the Hartford County Bar Association with Hartford current columnist Kevin Rennie and Nixon White House counsel John Dean. Dean, of course, is credited with cooperating with investigators and linking President Nixon to the Watergate scandal, but he was also called by the FBI the master manipulator of the cover-up. We've been talking about his history.
I know exactly where that line comes from.
Now I want to know.
It's frequently used. It was written by a report, a CYA. I won't put the that acronym. It's cover your...
something or other, yes.
Something or other.
Yes. Your rear end.
Memo by the Bureau very early. It's long before the Watergate prosecutor comes into play, and they're trying to protect themselves from an investigation they have clearly botched. And it's because they posted it online, it's gotten a lot of currency. But it is a very weak report of the FBI's fumbling and...
It is a line that has stuck to you over the years, though, in many ways. I just want to quickly, before we get to some questions from our audience, ask Kevin Rennie. Kevin, a quick response maybe to John Dean's answer before, because I think this is what you were getting at with your earlier question about the enemies list. It's the role of a lawyer in the White House, a young lawyer, someone who maybe doesn't understand what's going on in Washington quite as well as people who've been there for a while, and whether or not should have done something different. Kevin, I'd just like a quick response from you and maybe a follow-up.
Well, I think that John Dean wasn't involved in politics before he became the White House counsel. And I think that today he would not, as he was then, he wouldn't have been the White House counsel.
Well, that's not true. Most of the people who have followed me are not really politically... sophisticated,
but I think they have much deeper, closer ties.
I was so far ahead of my colleagues as far as knowledge of how Washington operated. I worked in the Department of Justice for the Attorney General. I was the liaison with Congress. I was the number 13th man in a 30-40,000 man department. I was more politically sophisticated than most of my colleagues. Ehrlichman and Haldeman, had come in from California in the campaign. While they
right, but they'd been in the campaign.
But that's a different type of politics than Washington politics.
No, I know, but what I'm saying, what I'm saying is that a White House counsel today is more likely to have a campaign, some campaign ties through, they're likely to have more, have had over the course of their career, more involvement in
campaigns. I would debate that with you. Both on who preceded me and who followed me, most of whom I know.
When you became the White House counsel, did you know Richard Nixon?
No. In fact, I didn't meet Richard Nixon until I'm in the job for years. I was in large meetings with him. As I said at the outset, he never really stops having John Ehrlichman as his White House counsel. I'm there doing the staff work. And there's a lot. The White House counsel files are huge, one of the biggest in the archives. But that doesn't mean you're having the interaction on a daily basis. In many regards, thankfully, because the president can waste an awful lot of people's time. And Richard Nixon talks for hours, and he's highly repetitive. That's one of the most difficult things in doing 1,000 taped conversations. There is almost 4 million words in these transcripts I did with grad students, and the repetition is just unbelievable. That he would go over the same point so many times, so many different people, and not get any different answer.
Of course, in those tapes, there is one portion that is lost to history. And that is the gap that at least purportedly was caused by the Rosemary
Stretch. Well, I did do a special appendix on the gap, and I did it because it's gotten such media interest. It has the answer to the question has absolutely zero historical significance. There are so many other places you can go for answers as to what happened on that 18-and-a-half-minute gap. My friend Jim Robinault, with whom I'll do the CLE this afternoon, got fascinated by this subject and actually came up with one of the great findings. Rose Woods, the president's secretary, would confess to erasing at least 5 minutes of this tape. Well, Jim did some digging, and because that investigation was called off, found the one technician in the United States, the machine she did it on, a Ur 5000, was a German import. And not many people in the United States understood how it was really operated. But to make a long story short, Rose Woods could not physically, mechanically, have erased the tape she thought she erased.
You know, some people in the audience may not know that I believe it was on the cover of maybe both Newsweek and Time, when she demonstrated what became known as the Rosemary Stretch, which was her outstretched from the tape recorder to the telephone to show how she inadvertently erased the
tape. It must have been quite a physical feat.
It became one of the vivid images of the Watergate scandal.
There are two lingering media questions that I decided that because they are lingering media questions.
I don't think it's just a media question about the tape, the gap in the tape. It wasn't just a media question.
It's a non-issue. It becomes after it's so mishandled when Nixon starts turning it over that it becomes a lasting media question. The answer to the question does not solve any Watergate problem, does not give you any insight into any Watergate character. Does not give you really any kind of historical information.
What was it that was on there?
It's very simple. That's what's not. I do address this in the book because after you listen to all the tapes, you know what's on there. And everybody thinks, oh my God, it's some big issue. They don't realize in the sequence of events that when it comes up, it's after Nixon has put up his firewall defense that he knows nothing about Watergate until I tell him in March 21st. Of 1973, he says, I didn't know there was a cover-up. Well, of course, that's a very dangerous defense. He will actually get forced out of office when on June 23rd it's shown that he had information and is very actively involved with the FBI and getting the CIA to cancel and deflect part of the investigation. But now the smoking gun tape, the 18-and-a-half-minute gap, are a little different. The gap tape comes up on the 20th, the first day he is back after the arrests at the Watergate. It's in a conversation with Haldeman in the morning. There's already been a very lengthy conversation with Ehrlichman in which Watergate isn't discussed at all. So by Haldeman's notes, we know it's a discussion of Watergate. Well, knowing what he knows that week and knowing the timing, the problem he has, and when this is discovered, either he orders or somebody operating on his best interest realize, if this tape surfaces, it will destroy his defense that he didn't know anything before March 21st. So it doesn't have to be a particularly big, important issue. All it has to be are other things that come up, like later that day or the next day. Any number of issues would have blown his defense. So it's not actually a big deal what he says. It's the time he said it.
We're listening back to a conversation I had live on stage at an event from the Hartford County Bar Association earlier this year. Our guests were Nixon White House counsel John Dean and Hartford Current columnist Kevin Rennie. Coming up, we'll hear from former Nixon advisor Roger Stone about how he views Watergate and John Dean's role in it. You hinted, though, earlier at one of the problems with ethics laws or reform of any sort, which is that invariably in politics you have people in power who want to either maintain power or get more of it. And we've used words like stupidity so far. Arrogance is certainly something that comes up. A naivete comes up in conversations like this. But you have people of power, and then you have lawyers or counsel who are, like you say you were, forced into situations in which they have no good option. They may be able to give counsel and say, don't do this, but at the end of the day, we have petty corruption in Connecticut cities. We have very large-scale corruption in our capital at times. How do we deal with the fact that when people in power want to gain more of it or maintain it, that they will bully those who maybe have good intentions into things that they feel they shouldn't do?
It is the most difficult problem in the whole realm of ethics, where you have a powerful figure who hires others to help him implement sometimes not always honorable ends. Excuse me. One of the things the ethics rule does do, the ethics rules in the model code does do, it empowers the lawyer in a way he or she has never previously been empowered. It gives them leverage to deal in these situations, which we'll go into this afternoon, the likes of which they've never had. And this changes the interplay between the potential wrongdoer and those who are asked to shepherd and address these issues. So that's probably the biggest change.
Kevin, did you want to jump in quickly?
Well, I two questions. But the first one is, since you didn't really know Richard Nixon very well or personally at all when you became the White House counsel, were you surprised at what he was like to work with?
I was. There were two Nixons. There was a public Nixon and a private Nixon. He's a very complex figure. He's a wonderful figure to write about. My editor, who's a very seasoned editor that's working on this big book where I've just done 1,000 tapes, we were going to kept trying to figure out how to cut this thing down. And I said, well, I've written this last part about as tight as I can. And he said, well, let me see if I can't squeeze out some more. Well, he didn't squeeze out much more because he said, I got caught up in the story. He said, this man is just, he never stops surprising you. And so he's a great character to write about, making it very difficult because he will do things you least expect when he does them. He's a very private man, but had a very different public persona than his private. Even his loyalist aides, I was reading something by Ray Price, who was a former newspaper person, ended up being his favorite speechwriter. And Ray, who Nixon often was very reluctant to talk about sort of down and dirty with. So he talks to different, he deals with different people on these tapes in different ways. You can hear he has one person with, say, Chuck Colson, who had at the time the ability to bring out the darkest side of this man, to Ray Price, who could bring out sometimes the best in him. Ray's advice to me, he wrote in his book, which is, if I had been in John Dean's situation, I would have shot myself. Well, I just didn't really think that was the option. I was ready to put a gun to my head for Richard Nixon. But he was loyal enough. He would have, he said. I didn't know him. You do get to know him. I don't think I got to know him until several meetings after I start doing one-on-one with him. The so-called March 21st cancer on a presidency, when I go in and tell Nixon how bad things really are, is the first time I think I really meet him. And it wasn't very pleasant what I found.
That's John Dean, former counsel in the Nixon White House. That conversation was recorded earlier this year at a conference hosted by the Hartford County Bar Association. We were joined on stage by Hartford Current columnist Kevin Rennie. When we come back from our break, we'll hear a different side of the story from Nixon advisor and political operative Roger Stone, who has a new book out on the Watergate scandal himself. It's all coming up next, Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up on tomorrow's show, it's a special edition of our weekly news roundtable, The Wheelhouse. We will recap the results of the big Republican primary races for governor and lieutenant governor, which are going on today. We'll also check in on several other closely watched races across the state, and we'll hear the story of one producer's attempt to register to vote in the primary. If you are registered for today's primary, I hope you are able to get out and vote, and we'll be talking about the results tomorrow on The Wheelhouse. Today in the program, we're looking back at the Watergate scandal and the fall of Richard Nixon. We've been listening to a conversation that I had with former White House counsel John Dean, who was credited with tying Nixon to Watergate, but was also called a master manipulator of the cover-up by the FBI. We're going to turn now to Roger Stone. He's a Republican political consultant whose new book is called Nixon's Secrets, The Rise, Fall, and Untold Truth About the President, Watergate, and the Pardon. He joins us by phone. Roger Stone, welcome to Where We Live.
I am delighted to be with you.
You've been very critical of John Dean and his role in the Watergate scandal, and we're going to get to that in just a moment. But I'm wondering first if you can explain your own relationship to Richard Nixon and the Nixon administration.
Yes, I'm a Connecticut native, and I was introduced by former Connecticut Governor John Davis Lodge to President Nixon in 1968. When I went to college in Washington, D.C. in 1970, Governor Lodge helped me secure a position in the White House press pool. I was 19 years old. I was cutting out newspaper clippings. I parlayed that into a position as the youngest staff member of the committee to reelect the president in 1972, and then went on to work for Ronald Reagan. In his post-presidential years, while living in New York, I became very close to former President Nixon in his retirement. Really got to know the man on a much more intimate level at that time.
One of the things that we talked to John Dean about was his assertion that he was a part of a different part, I suppose, of the Nixon administration, one that didn't really know Nixon from the campaign, that didn't know him at all personally. Do you feel as though there were two different factions, those who had worked with Nixon to get him elected and those who were part of the Washington machinery who were just, as John Dean says, part of that administration but weren't close to Nixon himself?
Nixon was a very private and introverted person in an extrovert's business, and therefore I'm not sure who, beyond his very close friends like B.B. Rebozo and the Yonkers businessman Robert Aplanath and a handful of others, really knew him well. I think we all knew largely the public Nixon. It wasn't until the 80s that I knocked back a couple martinis with Nixon and really got to know him. But so much of what John Dean says is inaccurate or not true. In this new book, which he's extolling, he completely truncates or omits the conversation of March 13th, 16th, 20th, 17th, and 20th. All of those are about the Watergate cover-up. In fact, Dean tells Nixon on the 13th how bad things are, not the 21st. and does this really to airbrush his own role out of the picture. It paints a far more benign picture of John Dean, and it excises a number of exculpatory things that Nixon said. Now, I don't argue that Nixon is blameless, but he is sucked into the cover-up by John Dean, not the other way around. I put all these tape transcripts and audio online so you can find and listen to them yourselves. The truth is John Dean is painting a very different picture than what actually happened.
Again, the picture that he told us about on stage is one that not so much that he's sucked into the Watergate scandal, Roger Stone, but that indeed by Nixon and others in the White House, he is bullied into it, that he essentially had no choice but to make some of the choices that he made. You don't buy it.
Yeah, no, I don't. Here's the problem. John Dean is the one man besides Gordon Liddy and Jeb Magruder who knows about the break-in in advance. How do we know this? Well, according to two decorated New York police officers who worked for Dean as an investigator, he had the Watergate cased out 6 weeks before the first break-in. Watergate burglar James McCord, one of the men arrested that night, tells the grand jury and the Senate Watergate committee that Dean knew about the break-in in advance. Additionally, it is Dean really who is the key man in the cover-up. So I would argue that Dean, Magruder, and Liddy are the guys who actually execute the break-in, and that Dean has been less than honest about what he knew and when he knew it.
We're talking with Roger Stone, whose new book is called Nixon's Secrets, The Rise, Fall, and Untold Truth About the President, Watergate, and the Pardon. He was a friend of Richard Nixon's and worked with him. And we're talking also about the role of John Dean, who we featured earlier in the program. We had a live conversation with him on stage some months ago. So what was the role then of the president in all this?
Well, the president is very definitely guilty in the cover-up. I mean, my book is not a love letter to Nixon, nor is it an excoriation. What I tried to provide here was a little more balance at the 40th anniversary of Nixon's resignation. Nixon was both very great and very flawed. He made enormous mistakes. In retrospect, he should have fired Dean and Magruder and Liddy. I prove in my book that it was John Dean who gave Nixon aide Jeb Magruder the order to give Gordon Liddy the go-ahead to break into the Watergate. He should have fired all of them as soon as he learned about this stunt. And then, of course, I think he should have destroyed the tapes before they were subpoenaed, so such destruction would not have been a crime. But Nixon held on to the tapes for one simple reason. He had to prove that it wasn't Henry Kissinger who orchestrated the opening to China. It wasn't Henry Kissinger who orchestrated the withdrawal from Vietnam. It wasn't Henry Kissinger who got a arms control reduction with the Soviets. It was Richard Nixon. Nixon was the strategist. Kissinger was the implementer, and Henry had enormous ability to take credit for things that he really didn't come up with and didn't do himself.
I'd like to ask you about something else that we spoke to John Dean about. His role in crafting the letter, which talked about screwing Nixon's enemies, and Dean's own role in creating an enemies list for the administration. Now, I understand from your background that some of your work was in opposition research, and even perhaps the types of dirty tricks that the Nixon campaign and administration was sometimes known for. I guess I'm wondering if you can tell us what you know about the genesis of the enemies list. John Dean essentially said it wasn't a real thing that ever impacted anybody. Of course, many who were on that list disagree. What's your take?
This is one area where John Dean and I agree. I really think the enemies list got hyped up at the time that Dean was trying to make a deal for immunity with the prosecutor, so he needed to give them something. He gave them two things, really. One was the famous Houston plan, a plan that would have stepped up surveillance, a warrantless surveillance of anti-war protesters and other critics of the administration. The Houston plan was never implemented. And then the so-called enemies list, which I think was really a list maintained by Chuck Colson to ensure that we did not inadvertently invite Nixon critics to the White House or otherwise socialize with him. You may recall when Eartha Kitt went to the White House under Lyndon Johnson, the famous singer Eartha Kitt, she used the opportunity to denounce the war in Vietnam and embarrass the president of the United States. So, it was a fantasy, but I don't think the enemies list really did impact anyone. In this case, John Dean is correct.
So this many years later, of course, we've been spending the better part of the last few weeks talking about the impact of Watergate. What do you think that we're missing? In part, you write this book to set, in your mind, some of the records straight. What are we missing in our conversation about Watergate and about Richard Nixon himself?
Well, first of all, that Nixon did not know about the break-in in advance, that John Dean did know about the break-in in advance. And then lastly, there is no Deep Throat. Deep Throat is invented to hide the fact that a number of the sources for Bob Woodward and Carl Bernstein are illegal sources, meaning lawyers who are leaking grand jury testimony regarding Watergate. That is, of course, a crime. So Ben Bradley, the editor of the Washington Post, the boss of Woodward and Bernstein, says in an interview with New York Magazine, there was no Deep Throat. Deep Throat is not mentioned in the original All the President's Men book proposal to Simon and Schuster. I have a copy of it. It's not there. It's added later as a literary device. There is no Deep Throat. What there is a series of sources, a group of people who are sources, who are grouped together as Deep Throat. And yes, Alexander Haig is definitely one of those.
We talked to John Dean about what one might do if you were a lawyer, not necessarily the White House counsel, but a lawyer in the White House who knew things that you thought were wrong. Do you, in your mind, have the moral obligation to speak up, to act up, even, as you say, to illegally turn things over to the press so as to uncover what you see as wrongdoing?
Well, in fact, that's, I guess, my whole point. If you listen to the conversations that he either truncates or omits entirely from his book, you see the president's lawyer urging him to commit crimes. What kind of a lawyer tells his client to break the law? Mr. Dean can start by releasing all the transcripts. He says his new book is definitive. He says that he has 463 new transcripts, over 1,000 hours of previously untranscribed tapes. Release them. Release them for third-party verification or peer review, independent analysis, to make sure that they are accurate. But he refuses to do so. And therefore, in all honesty, it's hard to take his book seriously because it's incomplete.
We just have 1 minute left, and I guess I'm wondering if you have thoughts on what Richard Nixon's legacy is now, and whether or not Watergate forever changed the view of the American presidency.
It very definitely does, but I think one of the things my book will do is remind people Richard Nixon ended the war, he ended the military draft, he got a deep arms reduction with the Soviets, he opened the door to China, he desegregated the public schools. He gave us the Environmental Protection Agency, the Clean Water Act, the Clean Air Act, the 18-year-old vote. And most importantly, he saved Israel from total annihilation in 1973 in the Yom Kippur War. Over the objections of Kissinger, over the objections of the State Department, over the objections of the Defense Department. So if you look at his actual accomplishments, so much of them have been lost in the ashes of Watergate.
Roger Stone is a Republican political consultant. He was an advisor to President Richard Nixon. His new book is called Nixon's Secrets, The Rise, Fall, and Untold Truth About the President, Watergate, and the Pardon. Thank you so much for joining us, sir. I appreciate it.
Delighted to be with you. Many thanks.
You can continue this conversation online at WNPR.org. Our show is produced by Tucker Ives and Lydia Brown. The executive producer is Katie Talarski. Remember, it is primary day, so get out and vote. We'll have all the results coming up tomorrow on The Wheelhouse here on Where We Live.